Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Keep up with the latest news and happenings at Beth Emmanuel by subscribing to our free monthly e-newsletter. Click on the News tab or go to BethEmmanuel.org/newsletter to sign up.
So we're going to start in John chapter 5 tonight. We're using, once again, the Delitzsch Hebrew Gospels. You find them on the end of the table there. And John chapter 5 is going to be on page 345. Now what we're studying, just a little bit of review before we get into the actual text, we're studying the seven signs of the Messiah from the Gospel of John. And this entire class is premised on the idea that John was using this as a narrative device, I should say, to organize his gospel and to move his gospel narrative forward. The idea that there are significant signs which indicate Yeshua is the Messiah, definitively indicate that Jesus is the Messiah. And so we got this idea from John chapter 2, when at the wedding at Cana, remember, the master turned the water into wine, and it said this was the first of his signs, which he revealed his glory. And so that leads to the question, well, if that's the first of his signs, what's the rest of the signs? And then last week we saw that there was another miracle that happened at Cana, and that was the long-distance healing, that long-distance healing episode where he healed the boy from Capernaum while he was there in Cana. He said to the man, he said, your son lives. And the man went home and he found that at the very time when Yeshua had said, your son lives, the boy had been healed. And then it said, this was the second sign that he performed. All right. So we see a pattern developing here. And this has led some scholars to speculate that underneath the text of the Gospel of John, there's an earlier proto-gospel called a signs gospel, a source document that John was using, compiling, perhaps also written by John, but a source that John's final editor was using to kind of draw these things together, to draw the teachings of John the Apostle together with these other episodes and events in the life of the Master. Who knows? Could be. Maybe. That could be the case. We don't know. But it's an interesting thought. What interested me when I was studying John and writing on it in the Chronicles of the Messiah was, if that's the case, if John is pulling together certain distinct signs that should indicate that Yeshua is the Messiah, that we should see these signs, we should say, okay, no question, this guy's definitely the Messiah. What are those signs from the narrative? And so I pulled out seven. You remember what they are? The first one, obviously, I've already given you. The second one I've given you. So the first one was the water to wine at Cana. The second one, the long-distance healing at Cana. The third one we're going to look at tonight, it's the healing at the pool of Bethesda in Jerusalem. And then the fourth one is the feeding of the multitude. Now you might think, feeding the multitude, okay, that's a good one. And right after that, he walks on the water. That must be the fifth one, but I didn't list the fifth one as the walking on the water. I left the walking on the water out. Why did I not list Why did I not list walking on the water as one of the signs? I think because I forgot about it. And I wanted there to be just seven. Well, actually, I might have had a better reason, which I'll explain later as we go on. Then we go on from the feeding of the multitude to the blind man in Jerusalem. This is an episode. He heals this blind man in Jerusalem and he has him go wash in the pool of Siloam. Remember that? Okay. And the boy sees. He's a young man. He's a young boy. Then I listed for number six, the resurrection of Lazarus. And for number seven, the resurrection of the Messiah himself. And potentially you could have an eighth one here too, another significant miracle that happens in the Gospel of John in the epilogue, and that is the miraculous catch of fish after the resurrection. Remember that story? That's the Dogma Omer story, right? Okay, so potentially we could add that one, but no, not adding that one for the same reasons. What makes these big signs? That's the question I was posing to you last week. With the wedding at Cana, it was really obvious. With the wedding at Cana, he was providing wine. And there's nothing more messianic, nothing more kingdom of heaven, messianic age-related than the abundance of wine. That's a strong tradition in Jewish tradition, is that there will be this abundance of the produce of the vineyard and this abundant wine, new wine, grain, new wine, and oil. Over and over again in the prophets it says the land will be filled with grain, new wine, and oil. And that's the whole agricultural cycle being expressed there. But so that one was easy. And we looked at several Jewish traditions that talked about in the Messianic era, the wine's going to be, and so forth. That one was easy. Last week, we were a little bit more puzzled. Because yes, healing and so forth is part of the kingdom. Healing is like the restoration. We're talking about the restoration of nature. We're talking about the restoration. Like there's going to be the resurrection. I mean, that's the restoration of the human body, the physical. A healing of the physical, yes, that's kingdom stuff, for sure. That's part of the Messianic era. But why that healing and not another healing? I mean, he's always healing people. It had just said that he had been in Jerusalem healing people. So why were none of those healings a sign? And this one is a sign. You see what I'm saying? So we're a little puzzled over that, okay? And I think I have an answer for you tonight on why these are signs. And if I don't remember to tell you what I think it is by the end of the class, remind me, okay? But for now, I want to go and start looking at the third sign, what I've identified as the third sign. And this is Yochanan chapter 5. We'll just read the text. Why don't I just read the whole story and then we'll go back and talk about it, okay? So I'm going to read, it'll be a long text I'm going to read here. After these things, there was a festival for the Yehudim, and Yeshua went up to Yerushalayim. In Yerushalayim, there was a pool near Sha'ar Hatzon, which is called in the Hebrew language Beit Chasda. It had five stoas. You know what a stoa is? It's a colonnade, okay? There were many sick, blind, lame, and weak people who were waiting for the water to move, for an angel descended at its appointed time to the pool and agitated the water in it. The first one to go down into it after the water churned would be healed from every ailment that clung to him. Do you see how that's in that section about the water moving and the angel coming down is set off in smaller text and in parentheses? The reason being that particular verse, that's verse 4, it's the end of verse 3 and all of verse 4, doesn't appear in the earliest, most reliable manuscripts of John. It's only in the later manuscripts, which suggests that it's something called a scribal gloss. A gloss is where a scribe has added a clarifying note to the text. So that could be the case. This might be a gloss. This might be a clarifying note. As in, a scribe is reading the text and he says, people aren't going to understand what's going on here. I better add just a footnote, you know, like adding a footnote to the text so that people realize what the situation was. Otherwise, they don't know why people were, why were the sick, blind, lame, and weak people waiting there? Okay. Verse 5, there was a certain man with a disease for 38 years. Yeshua saw him lying there and knew that the days of his disease were very long. Yes, very long, 38 years long. He said to him, do you desire to be healed? The sick man answered, my master, there is no one with me to cast me into the pool when the water is agitated, and before I come, someone else goes down before me. Yeshua said to him, arise, carry your bed and walk. Instantly, the man regained his strength, picked up his bed, and walked. That day was the day of Shabbat. The Yehudim said to the man who was healed, "It is Shabbat today. It is forbidden for you to carry your bed." He answered them, saying, "The man who restored me to health said to me, 'Carry your bed and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Carry your bed and walk'?" The man who was healed did not know who he was, for Yeshua had departed and went away because there was a large crowd in that place. Afterward, Yeshua found him in the holy temple and said to him, "Look, you are healed. Do not continue to sin, or else something worse than this may happen to you." The man went and told the Yehudim that Yeshua was the one who had healed him. Thus the Yehudim pursued Yeshua and sought to put him to death because he did things like these on Shabbat. All right, that's as far as I'm going to read. And we will, now we'll talk about it a little bit. First of all, let's start off in verse 1 where it says, there was a festival for the Yehudim, a festival for the Jews. In most English translations, it would say a feast of the Jews. And this language is a little bit troubling. Why is it troubling? Because John is Jewish. And it, when he says it like that, there was a Jewish festival, a festival of the Jews, it sounds like he's distancing himself from that identity. But we have to remember, John's community is not Jewish. John's community is primarily Ephesian. He's at least that's the tradition, that he's writing in Ephesus. And they don't know. They don't necessarily know the ins, the outs. And moreover, when he says it was a festival of the Yehudim, this indicates that it's a Judean festival. It could be nothing more than that, because there are three festivals where the Galileans, John is not Judean, he's not Yehudi in the sense of the word that it would have been used here, he's Galili, he's a Galilean. So there are three festivals where the Galileans all need to go to Judea. What are they? Passover, yeah, Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. So, which one do you think it is? You could say it's a festival of the Yehudim because you have to go to Yehuda in order to keep the festival if you're a Galilean. So, and these are called the pilgrimage festivals, right? Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. So which one do you think it is? Well, it's not Passover because we just had Passover. We just came from Passover a couple chapters ago. And he's going to be at Passover in the next chapter hence. And then there's not enough Passovers to go around. Okay, we'd run out of Passover. So it can't be Passover. So it's either Shavuot or it's Sukkot. And I'm not sure which. I'm not sure which, but it could be Sukkot. I like Sukkot. So let's just say it's Sukkot for tonight. We'll say it's Sukkot. Okay? So you got to go up to Jerusalem for Sukkot. So we went up to Yerushalayim. And in Yerushalayim was a pool near Sha'ar Hatzon. Now you think, what is Sha'ar Hatzon? So look over in the margin where it says Sha'ar Hatzon, and you'll see that means the sheep gate. Why was it called the Sheep Gate? Don't know, but maybe that's where you brought the livestock through. I don't know. Maybe that was that seems like the most reasonable explanation. You're near the Temple Mount at this location. Oh, you know what we should do? Let's go look at the map in the back. This map is on page 470. This is Yerushalayim in the time of Yeshua, the city of Jerusalem in the time of Jesus. Can you find Sha'ar Hatzon, the sheep gate? And you see that it leads right into the temple complex. So maybe that should give us a good clue of why it's called the sheep gate. This is where we bring the livestock for sacrifice through. All right, so do you see those four big blocky towers to the left of the Sheep Gate? Mm-hmm. That's called Fortress Antonia. Fortress Antonia, named after Antony of Antony and Cleopatra fame. Herod the Great named it after him when he was trying to curry his favor. And that is the Roman fortress that holds, it's like a cork on the top of Jerusalem. It's like the cork on the top of the bottle holds down Jerusalem from revolution. Keep a garrison of Roman soldiers there, and they march around, and they can look down into the temple and make sure there's no trouble. All right. Okay, and now you see where it says Beit Chasda pool. It's outside the gates. You see it? There's like two little squares up there. Okay, that's where this episode is happening. So it's outside of the city of Jerusalem. Now, it's called, Franz Delitzsch translated it as Beit Chasda, which I think would be like something like House of Compassion, House of, yeah, because it'd be like Chesed, you know, House of Mercy, something like that. But that's actually, and Franz Delitzsch could not have known this, so we won't fault him, but that's actually not what Bethesda means. He was trying to imagine, like, okay, because he's just looking at the Greek, right? So he's like, okay, Bethesda, 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 what would that have been in Hebrew? And he's trying to retroject it. What would that be in Hebrew? What would that be in Aramaic, right? So he's trying to figure this out. But he didn't have the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it wasn't until we got the Dead Sea Scrolls that we actually found this name represented in Hebrew or Aramaic. So I'll tell you this. I've been here. If you've been to Jerusalem, it's someplace you can go. You can actually go. It's nowadays it's inside the walls of the old city. But this is actually someplace you can go. You can go to the Pool of Bethesda. And you can look down into it. It's not much to see. There's no water in it. It's just, it's like you look and you say, whoa, there's a lot of old rocks down there. That's archaeology. And that's as much as you can really make out of it. There's arches and pillars and pieces of ancient churches and, you know, going way back into the Byzantine era. It's really, really amazing. I mean, to interpret this piece of archaeology and these enormous holes in the ground. It's like very difficult to get any sort of visualization of what this place would have looked like at all. And then John's description is a little cryptic too. He says there were five stoa or five colonnades. All right, what is that a pentagram? You know, how do you picture that, right? And so the archaeologists, looking at this, were able to piece it together and determine that rather than a pool with five walls, what you had was two pools. There is an upper pool and a lower pool. The pools are surrounded by a colonnade, you know, with the big columns on either side and a roof over you, so you can walk through, you can stroll through, it'd be quite beautiful, right? And then between the two pools, between the upper pool and the lower pool, there's another colonnade. So you actually would end up with four colonnades. I mean, three colonnades per pool, and then they share a common colonnade in the center. Are you able to visualize that? So then you've got five colonnades. This is the pool, my brother says, this is the pool that Isaiah refers to when the Lord says to him, go out and meet Ahaz at the upper pool on the highway to the washerman's field in Isaiah chapter 7. He goes out and gives him the Emmanuel prophecy. So this was a water reservoir. And in fact, prior to Herod the Great's changes, and he put in new waterworks and so forth, and as did Pilate, by the way, during the Roman era, this would have been the main water reservoir for Jerusalem in those days. Anyway, it's hard to visualize. So what I did was I printed off a couple photos. Well, these are black and white photos, but these are pictures of a model from a model of what it looks like. And so I want you to see, you got your pool, your upper pool here, your lower pool here, and then you see those four enormous towers behind it. That's Fortress Antonia. So sitting over here to the side, you can just catch a little glimpse of the Temple Mount and the temple. Okay, so I'll let you look at these. So that's actually a photograph of a big model from the Israel Museum. Anyway, so what I was going to tell you, all of that was to tell you that in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we find the Dead Sea Scrolls, it makes reference to some place in Jerusalem called Beit Eshdatayin. I think I said that correctly. Beit Eshdatayin, which apparently means the house of two springs. And so this got truncated, this difficult mouthful of Aramaic got truncated into the Greek just as Bethesda. That makes sense. What doesn't make so much sense is this whole thing about the water stirring, and and the angel of the Lord coming down, that gloss on that. I mean, what's going on there? Oh, another thing in the archaeology that was found is that after the temple era, when the city becomes a Roman city, this site continues to be used as a healing center. It becomes an Asclepion, which is associated with the Greek god Asclepius, who is the god of healing, Roman god of healing. So it continued to be a spa and a place that people would go to seek healing even after the destruction of the temple. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. And that's a very common thing in the Roman world, that you would have these sort of spas and hospitals and so forth where you went to seek healing. So, I guess that begs the question. Who's stirring the waters around here? Is it the angel of the Lord, or is it the Roman god Asclepius that's coming down and stirring the water? And, the two aren't exactly mutually exclusive because, it could just depend on who's interpreting the event, right? There's something going on here. In Judaism, it's not unusual to find, if you're reading the Talmud or the Midrash, to find these associations with pools and spirits. Like there's a spirit that's associated with a particular pool, sometimes even with a bathhouse, just with a collection of water. It tends to draw a spirit, I guess. But when you think about like the story of Naaman, the leper, what's he told to do? He's told, go immerse yourself in the Jordan, and he's healed, right? So seven times, immerse yourself seven times. And in the story of the blind man in Jerusalem, that sign number five, Yeshua tells him to go to a different pool. He tells him, go down to the pool of Siloam and immerse yourself, right? There's another pool in the city. And so we already have these kinds of associations with healing and pools. But this is kind of strange, this angel coming down. I have a theory about the stirring of the water myself. You've got an upper pool and a lower pool, right? And so, not to take away any of the magic from the story, but I'm thinking from time to time you had to open You had to open some sort of valve or something to drain from that lower, that upper pool into the lower pool, you know. And when that would happen, there'd be like some blurbling that would probably happen. The water would get stirred up. This is, you know, not as great as an angel coming down and with a big stick and stirring it up. But, you know, I don't know if they're mutually exclusive.
Daniel, have you ever been to Boiling Springs down in Savage, Minnesota?
No.
It's an artesian spring, and it does exactly what this describes. It boils up every once in a while because of the change in water pressure.
It's a water pressure and not a water temperature thing?
It's a water pressure thing, is my understanding of it. That's correct.
So you could possibly have that going on here, like an artesian sort of like just all of a sudden it just starts to froth and bubble up and so forth, and then it settles down. Yeah. Yeah. How else are you going to describe what's going on there? Then an angel comes down and stirs it up.
Doesn't this seem to suggest there was already a history of people being healed when they went in?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's got to work. Otherwise, I mean, this is what the guy's complaint is. He's like, the reason I'm still here 38 years later, right, is because everybody else is faster. They get in the water, they get their healing. Apparently, it's only the first one in, though. It's kind of a bad system. I don't know. I think it really enjoy this idea of an angel descending at the appointed time, agitating the water.
Only one.
And then the first one to go in after it. Regardless of, what the situation is and how it works, Yeshua sees this fellow, and he has compassion on him. I mean, that's the indication. There's a lot of people there that he could have healed. There's a lot of sick people there. But this fellow, he sees this guy, and he has compassion on him because he realizes he's been there for a long, long time. He says, you want to be healed. And of course the guy wants to be healed. And so he says, arise, carry your bed, and walk. I would be too cynical to try. I'd be like, who are you? But you know, isn't it interesting that he doesn't say anything about who he is? Or this guy doesn't know who he is, because later when he's asked about it, he's like, I don't know. Some guy said, arise, carry your bed and walk. So I did. It worked. He didn't say, he didn't leave a card. He didn't tell me his name. And this, to me, when I was looking at this today, I realized, well, this indicates that even though John might think this is a sign, this is one of the major signs that proves that Yeshua is the Messiah. Yeshua didn't see it that way. And he wasn't doing the healing in order to, like, time to do another sign, time to do another proof that I'm the Messiah. In fact, you think about them so far, and that's not been the case. The first one, he didn't want to do anything. His mother forced him, right? She forced him into it. And the second one was this guy who came up from Capernaum and said, please come with me. He's like, I don't want to go down there. Your son's fine. You know, he wasn't going that direction. He was going to Nazareth, right? He wasn't like, time for a sign, right? But these are the, and it says this is a sign. So too with this one. He doesn't make any announcement, and he never does. He never, when people ask him for a sign, what does he say? He says, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign. No sign will be given except for the sign of Jonah, right? There's going to be, which is what's the sign of Jonah? That you should repent, you know, like Jonah's message, repent. Or this city will be destroyed in 40 days. That's the sign of Jonah. So he says, sailors know how to read the sky, you know, red at night, sailor's delight, red in the morning, sailor take warning, right? It's a little different in the way he said it, but. So he doesn't do signs. So the fact that these are signs, that's in the eye of the beholder. John is interpreting these as signs, saying these are the signs that people should take note of. Why? What makes these particular things signs. He tells the man to pick up his to pick up his bed and walk. And it's like it's not a bed, you know, it's a bedroll. It's a bedroll. You can roll it up, put it over his shoulder, and walk off. And then some people see him and they say, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, where are you going with that? Today's Shabbat." What you have to understand about their objection is that in Jewish law, it's actually, you know, forbidden to carry on the Sabbath, to carry any object on the Sabbath. I'm not talking just like a bed. I'm like even the smallest, most insignificant object. You can carry your clothes if you're wearing them. You know, you have to wear them. If you ever see men walking to synagogue on Shabbat with the talit on. Ever see that? You know, people don't do it here because they keep their talits here generally, you know, but you'll see that sometimes. Men walking to synagogue with the talit on because that's the only way to get it there. It's not because they're showing off like, "Look how pious I am. I have my holy garment on." It's because they have to wear it to get it there. Now, the rule of not carrying only applies outside. It doesn't apply inside. Inside, you can carry all you like. You can rearrange the furniture. You can, whatever you want to do. You're not breaking the Sabbath. But to carry something just three paces outside, that's a problem on the outside. Why? Where does this even come from? Well, it comes from what you could call a rigid reading of Jeremiah 17, where Jeremiah has this prophecy. "Thus says the Lord, take heed for yourselves and do not carry any carried thing on the Sabbath day or bring anything in through the gates of Jerusalem. You shall not bring a carried thing out of your houses on the Sabbath day, nor do any work, but keep the Sabbath day holy as I commanded your fathers." All right, so from a more of a contextual point of view, maybe we look at that passage in Jeremiah and say, I think he's really talking about merchandise, you know? But that's not how Jewish law interpreted it. Jewish law said, okay, we also have a story about a guy carrying sticks on the Shabbat in the Torah, and he got stoned to death. You know, so we think we just shouldn't carry stuff on Shabbat. Okay. And that's the rule, that's the law. So here's the question then. If that's the rule, that's the law, that's how Judaism has interpreted this commandment, and you know, then why does Yeshua tell this guy to get up and carry your mat? And I'll give you a few possible answers. Possible answer number one. He is making a point to say, I disagree with the interpretation on carrying and not carrying. I'm trying to show everybody that that is not the correct interpretation of the Torah and the Sabbath. Okay, why doesn't that work? That doesn't work for the following reasons. One, that would be unkind to make this guy your public example. But two, he didn't make him a public example. He didn't even stay around. He didn't say anything. Three, he could have told the guy, it's not a sin to carry on the Shabbat. Carry on the Shabbat. He didn't. He just said, get up, take your mat, and walk. Four, Yeshua doesn't get into halakhic disputes. Not like this. He doesn't do this. That's kind of beneath his dignity. That kind of legal. He stays with what he calls the weighty matters of the Torah: justice, mercy, and faithfulness. Yeah, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. So he dismisses the other stuff as the straining of gnats. You know, he doesn't wade in there with that kind of argument. Another reason, we don't see that his disciples are ever accused of carrying on the Shabbat. It's not a thing that ever comes up again in the text. And in fact, at one point he warns them. He says, pray that your flight will not come on the Sabbath. Why? Why should they pray that their flight doesn't come on the Sabbath? It's permissible to flee on the Sabbath to save your life. but it's not permissible to carry your suitcase with you on the Sabbath. So I'm not buying that this was in order to change Jewish law. It's just not really in his character. It's not what he does. Another possible explanation. This one from Rabbi David Stern. David Stern says, well, there's no issue here. And, you know, David Stern lives in Jerusalem. So he knows. There's no issue here. The Pool of Bethesda is inside the walls of Jerusalem. That's inside a private domain. Within the walls is called an eruv. That's within boundaries. You know, it's like being inside a house. It's not a problem. Why doesn't this explanation work? Yeah, because he got in trouble. Then why did he get in trouble? and even more to the point, you saw on the map. You saw on the map in the back of the book, Bethesda is outside of the walls of Jerusalem. Now, in the days of the apostles, in the days of the book of Acts, the walls of Jerusalem expanded when Herod Agrippa put in a new wall, and the new wall line came around Bethesda and wrapped it in. And it is to this day inside the walls of Jerusalem. But not in the days of Yeshua. The wall line hadn't moved out that far yet. Make sense? So, no, he's on the outside. So, what's the issue? Why is he telling him to do this? And as we read forward in the text, we'll see that when the Pharisees confront Yeshua about this healing, and they're not going to let this go. They're still talking about this in John 7. There's still this particular healing that happened on the Sabbath. When they confront him regarding this healing, they don't mention anything about the carrying of the mat. Instead, their issue is that he healed on the Sabbath at all. And this is something that we see to be a consistent objection to the ministry of Yeshua throughout all four Gospels, and one of his main talking points in confrontations with the Pharisees. In fact, this is his very first time he's had confrontation with religious authorities whatsoever. This is his first face-off with the religious authorities. And it's over this issue, and this will be the primary issue that continues to define his conflict with them through the rest of the gospel narratives. What is it? The question of whether or not it is permissible to heal on the Sabbath. And, you know, that's a whole nother class. That's a whole nother discussion. I wrote a whole book on that. It's called The Sabbath Breaker, right? We could talk about that. But the long and short of it is that the opinion of Yeshua, based on the text in Hosea that says, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, is that compassion for human beings is of a higher priority than ceremonial law. And so when you have the opportunity, when you're confronted with the need, with human need, and have it within your ability to offer compassion, to meet that need, for human dignity, for the sake of human dignity, that the mitzvah, the commandment to do so, overrides the commandment not to perform work on the Sabbath. That's the short version. That's the synopsis. We could talk about that. Okay. So, I would apply the same principle here to the question of the mat. We may safely assume that after 38 years of paralysis, the man at Bethesda had no other possession to his name than the bedroll upon which he slept. The Torah shows special concern for such a situation. A passage in Deuteronomy creates a hypothetical scenario in which a poor man must secure a loan from a creditor. The poor man has nothing to offer for collateral except his cloak, which also doubles as his bedroll. The Torah warns the creditor not to keep the collateral overnight. The creditor must return the man's cloak before sunset so that he will be able to sleep in it. If the creditor will do so, the Lord will reckon his act of mercy on the man as righteousness. So here's the actual text. When you make your neighbor a loan of any sort, if he is a poor man, you shall not sleep with his pledge. When the sun goes down, you shall surely return the pledge to him, that he may sleep in his cloak and bless you, and it will be righteousness for you before the Lord your God. So in John 5, the sick man's bed is equivalent to the poor man's cloak. Would the master have told the man, get up and walk, abandon your mat here, because today is the Sabbath? Would that not have violated the spirit of the commandment? Yeshua prioritized chesed, mercy, above ceremonial concern, and told the man to get up, go, take his mat with him. And in so doing, Yeshua did not abrogate the prohibition on carrying on the Sabbath, declare that prohibition illegitimate. Neither did he criticize Jewish tradition about the Sabbath. Instead, he acted according to a higher ethical standard that says mercy on a human being overrides ceremonial prohibitions when necessary. Even according to a strict rabbinic law, human dignity should take precedence. Let me explain the strict rabbinic law. I've sort of oversimplified the whole carrying on the Sabbath thing to say, well, there's inside a private domain and then there's outside. There's actually three different kinds of domains. There's inside a house, under a roof, inside a house. That'd be one, okay? Then there's outside, just outside in the open, and that's two. You can carry inside, not outside. We got that, right? But what about, let's say, you know, we got the Mitchells over there and the Blackfords over there, right? And their houses are like just adjacent here. What if we wanted to say, what if we just create like a common domain? So this is all one domain, like our parking lot. And we just, you know, we got the fence on the parking lot. So we just extend a line, you know, just like this, we'll call this one domain. All right. And so that's called an eruv, the border, right? And so everything within the eruv border, then we say, okay, now this is one domain we can carry. So we can carry stuff to the Mitchells, we can carry it back, and so on and so forth, right? Okay. That would be a great innovation, don't you think? I mean, it would be for the Blackfords, at least. So that's called an eruv. And there are different kinds of eruv domains. Some, it's permissible to carry within when it's very clearly marked and it's very clear and easy to understand, such as within a walled city. You know, it's like, oh, within the walls of the city, that's easy. Some are less clear, and these are called the Carmelite. I don't even know what that word means, but they're called Carmelite. And the Carmelite is where it's permissible by strict law, but it would be easy to be mistaken about such a situation, and so we just forbid it anyway. It would be easy to like think this is Carmelite, but it's actually not Carmelite. And there's lots and lots of situations like this, where this could be within Eruv, but maybe it is, maybe it isn't. And so we just say it isn't. And, you know, an area around a major city often would have a lot of these Carmelite-type neighborhoods, you know, and that sort of thing. So there are examples in the Talmud where the prohibition of carrying in Carmelite is overridden in order, for the very same reason, not for a healing, but for human dignity, for the sake of human dignity. Like, because it's not a biblical law, it's a rabbinic law, if you like. The biblical law, you can't carry outside. That's biblical law. That's, you can't carry on Shabbat. That's a biblical law. I'm telling you the interpretation of Jewish law. But that you can't carry in Carmelite, that's just the sages. There's some flexibility there. There's a little bit of wiggle room there. Because that's just, that's rabbinic law. So if it's if it needs to be set aside, it can be set aside for the sake of human dignity. So there's a few examples of this in the Talmud. And this seems to me to be very much the situation that we have here. Where people say, what are you doing? You're carrying on the Shabbat, but there's human dignity involved in this situation. And this would answer to the question of why then we don't see this become an issue any further. So when we get to John chapter 7, and they challenge him, they don't say to him, hey, you're that guy who told that other guy to carry on the Shabbat. Instead, they say, you're that guy who healed on the Shabbat. That's their real issue with him, is the healing on the Sabbath. All right, so we don't know. I mean, that's just so much speculation on, because John loses interest in the whole carrying thing right away, and he's going to focus on the question of healing. So we get into this conversation. The man goes up to the temple. He goes up to the temple. Maybe he goes to the temple to thank God. He's going to thank God. Like, this miracle happened to me. 38 years. You know, 38 years. If someone's paralyzed for 38 years, I mean, even if they're like, suddenly their nervous system kicks back in and starts to move those muscles aren't ready to start moving. You know? There's multiple levels to a miracle like this. Mm-hmm. So this man is in the temple, and he sees, Yeshua sees him, and he goes up to him and says, "Oh, what happened to you? Look, you're healed." He says, "Do not continue to sin, or else something worse than this may happen to you." She says this kind of thing. Well, there are worse things that can happen to you. So now he knows who Yeshua is. He realizes who Yeshua is. He finds out his name. He goes and tells the people who are asking him, the one who healed him. I don't think he has any malice. It's not like he's going like, you know who healed me? It was that guy. Go get him. You know, they asked him, who healed you? Now he can tell them. And as far as he's concerned, he's spreading the fame of this healer that did this amazing miracle for him, right? But the rabbinic authorities here don't see it that way. They see it as a problem. And so they pursue him. And they bring this charge against him that he does things like this. He healed on the Shabbat. And Yeshua says, well, my Father carries out his action even until now, and I also take action. Or another way to put it, my Father's working even till now, and I'm also working. Which is a provocative thing to say anyway. And so then they sought his life even more, because not only did he profane the Shabbat, but he said that God is his Father, and he compared himself to God. All right, I can understand. That's not going to help his case. He attempts to address the question from a few angles now. He'll go on, he address the question from a few different perspectives, mystical and perspectives, really. When we get to John chapter 7, he'll take another angle with it. He'll take another run at this. He actually takes a halakhic angle on it. We get to, I think it's in John chapter 7. Maybe it's 8. 7 or 8. Could be 8. Maybe it's, I don't know, somewhere around there. It's like a year later. And he says to them, you're still upset because I healed one guy. You know, I did one thing and you're still upset. He says, but let me ask you something. If a baby boy is born on the Shabbat, don't you perform a surgery on Shabbat? Don't you break the Shabbat by performing surgery for him? You know, to a circumcision? Right. The following Shabbat, 8 days later, because the circumcision always takes place on the eighth day, so the Brit Milah takes place on Shabbat. The baby's born on Shabbat, there's going to be a Brit on the Shabbat, right? So he says, so for this one thing for taking care of this one part of the body, you know, you'll break the Sabbath. Well, I healed the whole guy. And this is Rabbi Meir uses the same exact argument in the Talmud to justify using medicine on Shabbat and preparing medicine on Shabbat. Because preparing medicine's a problem. You got to grind stuff. That's real work, you know. And he says, look, it's permissible to circumcise on Shabbat to heal one part of the body. It should be permissible to do this on Shabbat as well. He stole that argument right from us. Stole that right from Yeshua. Or maybe it was just a common argument. For the question of whether it's permissible to heal on Shabbat or not. Okay, that's the controversy, and that controversy carries on in the Synoptic Gospels as well, and we'll see it again when we get to the blind man in Jerusalem, the story of the blind man in Jerusalem, because there again, when he heals that blind man, that's the one where he makes the mud and the spittle, puts it on the blind man's eyes, right? Tells the blind man to go wash in the pool of Siloam, and it happened to be on the Sabbath day. Also, another Shabbat and healing, and this become an issue. In fact, in that story, when we get to it, we'll learn about it, but when we get to it, you'll see that that one actually gets called up to the Sanhedrin. That blind man is taken before the Supreme Court and told to testify. His parents are brought in and made to testify before the Supreme Court. I mean, it's a big deal, right? And this is my theory for why these are signs. They're not signs in the sense that Yeshua said, now I'm going to do a sign, now I'm going to do an amazing feat of wonder that will prove to you that I am the Messiah. He's just doing what he always does. He's bringing the kingdom. He's got one foot in the kingdom. He sees a human being in need and he acts with compassion, right? So why are they signs? Because these seven signs happened publicly. Lots of people saw it. Lots of people heard about it. Lots of people were witness. Here, just run through the list with me. Water to wine at Cana, public, a wedding, lots of witnesses. Long distance healing at Cana. We saw there were people with him. The guy who came to get his son healed was a notable official from the court of Herod. Remember? From the court of Herod Antipas. That's what it said. A high profile healing, in other words. Healing at the pool of Bethesda. We see it's a notable thing that got him in trouble with the sages. You know, the sages saw this. He got called on the carpet, they say, regarding this one. It was a high-profile healing. Feeding of the multitude. 5,000 people were witness to this miracle. The blind man in Jerusalem. The whole Sanhedrin gets called into this one. The resurrection of Lazarus. This one's huge. This one is so huge that there's people leaving Jerusalem to go out to Bethany to see Lazarus. They're like, you're the dead guy. And they're coming back and forth and to the point where Caiaphas is saying, you know, maybe we should kill that dead guy. You know, because they're plotting against him. They plot to maybe have him put down because of all these people who, so very, very high profile. And then, of course, number seven, the resurrection of Yeshua himself, the empty tomb. You know, that's the big one, right? But if you think about it then, the ones that I've left out from John, the big miracles from John that I left out, the walking on the water. Who saw that? Just his disciples. You're not going to trust that. Or the miraculous catch of fish. Who saw that? At least in John's version of the story. It's just the disciples. You know, who knows what happened? So these other miracles, these other things that they're not on the same level of big public recognition. And so I think that is actually what makes these signs signs. They weren't signs that he was doing to signify. He was just doing business as usual. Like you said, my father is working until now, and I'm working. Right? I'm just doing the stuff that I do. And he says, the apprentice does what he sees the master do. The son does what he sees the father do. I'm doing what my father does. I'm not interested in doing signs. But they're signs in the sense that they're big public events. Yes.
I was going to let you finish. When he refers to the priests who are working in the temple and they're guiltless, what kind of work are they doing it?
Oh, okay. This is a good question. So this is in regard to the same question of, is it permissible to heal on the Sabbath? And he runs the argument like this. Here's his argument, and this is from the Synoptic Gospels, not from John, but this is how he poses the argument. He says, okay, have you never read in the Tanakh where David was hungry? And then he went to Abiathar, the priest, and Abiathar gave him the sacred bread, which is permissible only for the priest to eat. And yet he was guiltless. And have you never read in the Torah that the priests minister in the temple, even on the Sabbath, and yet they're guiltless? Okay, so what are the priests doing? Ministering in the Sabbath, there's a lot of stuff. They have to bake bread. They have to make bread and bake bread. That's the
on the Sabbath.
On the Sabbath, that's the show bread. They have to sacrifice animals. They have to light fires. They have to burn incense. They have to slaughter and gut things and flay things, and it just goes on and on and on. The number of ways that a priest breaks the Sabbath is too many to count. So follow the logic of the argument. He says, okay, David's hungry. In other words, he has a human need. He and his men, they're hungry. And so the priest says, you know what? Human need overrides the ceremonial concern that this bread is sacrosanct to the priesthood and no common person is ever supposed to eat this, but I see you're starving, so I'm going to give this to you. All right. And then he says, and moreover, the priesthood themselves, they break the Sabbath, but they have a higher commandment. And what's the higher commandment that makes them innocent so that they can break the Sabbath? It's that they have a mitzvah to do all this stuff on the Sabbath. They have to carry out the sacred service. So he says, you have a principle here that there are things of greater weight than keeping the Sabbath. What's of greater weight than keeping the Sabbath? The temple service. And what's of greater weight than the temple service? David's hunger. That David was hungry. You see, there's like a level of priority going on here in Yeshua's argument. And he says, and what was it with my disciples? Why they were breaking the Sabbath by husking grain in their hands? Because they were hungry. Because, so that's the argument. But all of this is meant to illustrate, this whole conversation that he has is meant to illustrate, to justify why he heals on the Sabbath. Because more than hungry, these people are broken, and he's fixing them.
Thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel is committed to proclaiming the vital gospel message of the coming kingdom of heaven. If you share our passion for this message, please support this teaching ministry and messianic community with your prayers and financial contributions. To learn how, click on the support tab at BethEmmanuel.org.